All right. Thank you once again. This is the It's Going Down podcast. This is the second installment from the ROAR, or Revolutionary Organizing Against Racism conference that took place several weeks ago in Oakland and San Francisco. This one is coming to you from the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee. It was a group that in many ways foreshadowed what was to come with Anti-Racist Action, or ARA, in the late 80s and early 1990s on into the early 2000s, and really led in many ways to what we see as anti-fascism or antifa, what we have today. This is a great conversation. We're really glad that these elders could come out and give their experiences and really talk about kind of the strategies that they used before the internet. You couldn't just go on a website and post on Instagram. You really had to get out there and use other forms of communication, have really strong networks and ways to organize. And also they really talk about what it means to have a base of support within broader struggles and broader movements and other communities that necessarily they didn't have access to starting off. So we're really glad the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee could be recorded, that they gave their okay for us to broadcast this. We're excited to have this conversation and look back at what our elders have done and how we can improve on it and how we can move forward. If you're just tuning in, be sure to go to itsgoingdown.org. Sign up to become a monthly sustainer. Please drop some money in our tip jar. And as always, you can share our stuff on social media, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, all social media platforms. Thanks a lot for listening, and let's get into it.
So by the early to mid 70s, many, many black former members of the Black Panther Party were in prison throughout the New York State prison system. So it came to pass that many of us who started out doing anti-racist Panther support work found ourselves doing prison work by the early to mid 70s. And prisoners at Napanock State Prison, which is a maximum security prison in New York State, contacted us and told us that guards at the prison, in fact, the guard that was the head of the prisoners, the guards union, were in the Ku Klux Klan. And our initial response was to think, well, they mean the guards are really, really racist. They couldn't possibly mean that they're actually in the Ku Klux Klan. But indeed, they struggled with us and urged us to research this. And since, of course, there was no internet then, it meant driving up to Albany, the capital of New York State, which is what you had to do to look at some company's incorporation papers. And we found out when we looked at the New York State Ku Klux Klan incorporation papers that the guy who was on the incorporation papers was the very self-same guy who was head of the prisoners union, the guards union at that prison, and who was also in charge of the internal prison education program. And thus, on the East Coast, the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee was formed. And I think that one of the things that's important about, for me, when I look back at that story, even though I wasn't necessarily entirely conscious of it at the time, was the critical nature of black leadership in building an anti-white supremacist movement. Because black people reached out to us, gave us guidance, which at first we rejected, and then when we actually listened to what they had to say, it turned out they were right. And then that propelled our movement forward. And I think another thing about one that made us different and continued to make John Brown Anti-Klan Committee different from the rest of what was then the traditional left was an understanding of white privilege. Now, I know for most of you and for people, political activists today, white privilege is a common part of political parlance. But this was not always true. And it was not true in the left, the white left and the traditional labor movements and so on of the 60s and 70s and of course before then. Because the traditional standard working class analysis of how American capitalism worked and you can see where that's gotten us, was different from what we thought. We were from a part of the movement that was broader than us. It included Weatherman, the Weather Underground, May 19th organization, and a few others that looked at this country and we said, the primary contradiction is racism and white supremacy. And by primary contradiction, I mean basically, if you crack that one, everything else falls apart as well. And likewise, if you crack that and can address that, everything else can be addressed as well. And when we looked at this country, we saw a settler colony. Everybody here knows about the history of this country. White settlers moving in, stealing land, committing genocide, slavery. And so we saw that this country was a white oppressor nation with oppressed nations inside the borders. That included the Black Nation, Puerto Rican, Mexicano, Chicano nations, Native American nations, and that the character of revolution in our society, therefore, would be not a typical proletarian revolution, but based on the liberation of oppressed nations and the destruction of the white oppressor nation. And that was pretty challenging for most white people. And it still is. So even though today white privilege is a critical part of a revolutionary analysis, how we put that into practice and what it means in day-to-day is still a big challenge that I hope we'll have an opportunity to discuss soon. So starting at with the prisons in the mid-70s, we also were the first people to develop an analysis of what we called the Nazified Klan. We looked at the traditional Ku Klux Klan, racist, flag waving, love America, apple pie, but they did not have an international worldview. Whereas the Nazis did have an international worldview, a commitment to fascism, a deep love of white supremacy, anti-Semitism, and in the early 70s and throughout the 80s and 90s, the Nazis in this country made a move to basically colonize and embrace the traditional regular white supremacist Ku Klux Klan. And, you know, we're seeing today the fruition of 30 years of that strategy in the alt-right. But it began in Greensboro, North Carolina, and was that 1979?
79, yeah.
Is it 79?
Mm-hmm.
When the police stepped aside and allowed Nazis and Klan demonstration to murder anti-Klan activists. And that leads us to another part of our analysis that I think made us unique, and that was our view of white supremacy interwoven with the state. And maybe Les would like to talk about that.
Well, I think the example that Lisa just gave, where the cops explicitly did not prevent what was a massacre of anti-Klan activists is an example of that. And we also see that continuing and having become even more entrenched, where attitudes of white supremacy pervade every element of the state. We're now experiencing such an extreme example of that, and it's all out in the open. So what that history of right-wing organizing has led to is sort of the normalization of that whole extreme discourse. When John Brown Anti-Klan Committee formed in San Francisco, by then there was explicit organizing of young people going on. A lot of it was influenced by a guy in Southern California, what was his first name, Metzger?
Tom
Metzger. who eventually was defeated by the Southern Poverty Law Center, who succeeded in getting Metzger convicted in Oregon of having, from a long distance, because he's based in California, encouraged and essentially instigated the murder of an Ethiopian man. And the Southern Poverty Law Center sued him, and he was forced into lifelong bankruptcy, essentially. Metzger's influence on skinheads in the Bay Area became a major focus of ours at that time. Skinheads were mobilizing and were clearly being encouraged by the Nazified Klan, and Metzger specifically, to demonstrate, to organize, to be street bullies. And so we mobilized against that. Hate Street, for example, was a sort of prime territory for the skinhead Nazis to sort of strut and make themselves evident and bully and be bullies and tough guys and so on. Some of the things that we did, we set up informational kiosks on Hate Street. We actually got attacked a few times by the Nazis while we were out there. We had posters and so on and handed out literature. And of course, we did a lot of t-shirts. I thought we needed a little color here, so I set them up. These are classics, not available at any price. Anyway, in what year was Arian Woodside?
1989.
In 1989, skinheads throughout California organized an Arian Woodstock. In
Napa.
No, it was in Riverville, I thought.
No,
Napa. Oh, okay. All right. Sorry. When you get to be my age, it gets a little fuzzy. And we organized a very large demonstration to confront the skinheads in Napa. We also actually appeared before the city council to try to prevent this Arian Woodstock from taking place, but also to alert people in that community that this was going on. And it did play a role in alerting people, and we actually had quite a large demonstration.
Can I just answer?
Yes, please do.
Actually, one of the things about the Arian Woodstock is that it raised many of the same issues that the Annapolis appearance of Berkeley raised, because it was happening on private property. So when we went in front of the city council, we didn't actually think we were going to convince the city council to stop it from happening. But we thought, A, it was worth a try, and more importantly, it allowed us to magnify our voice and find people in Napa and the areas around there who would approach us after the meeting, and it would make us accessible to people who were like-minded on any level. And it also allowed us to talk about the issues of what's free speech. And that's one of the ways that I see it as similar to the Annapolis thing, because it allowed us to say, look, the right to free speech means the government can't put you in prison for saying bad things about the government. It doesn't mean any asshole gets to say anything they want, anywhere they want to say it, without receiving the opprobrium of their fellow citizens. And so we were so current in 1989. Little did we know we'd be finding ourselves in exactly the same situation, lo these many years later. And so the thing in Napa was interesting. Needless to say, the city council did not put a stop to it, much like the university. They claimed they didn't have any right to put a stop to it because it was on private property, which might be actually a better argument than the university had. And so, as Les was saying, we organized a massive demonstration. And this posed other questions that are so similar to the things we're struggling with today. Because when you call for a massive demonstration against the Ku Klux Klan, and literally thousands and thousands of people showed up, much to our amazement and joy. But when thousands of people show up, you can't control them. So we had to learn to embrace every form of anti-racist expression and to do what we were going to do, but not be mad at other people who were going to do what they were going to do, even if it was different from what we had in mind. And that was a struggle. And I think that's a struggle that continues to face all of us today. And something that we're going to have to learn to deal with or continue to wrap our minds around. Because really, we never imagined in the 1980s that the things that we were going to be dealing with, that we were dealing with then, would be exactly the same in terms of organized white supremacy, and in fact, more legitimized and more normalized today than they were then. I mean, one of the advantages that we had was that, frankly, neo-Nazis and Nazi skinheads and the Ku Klux Klan were considered fringe. And I mean, on the one hand, it was a struggle because sometimes it's hard to get people to take something seriously if they think, oh, it's just the whack jobs over there. On the other hand, it's good when somebody really bad and a really bad ideology is just the whack jobs over there. Well, now the whack jobs are in the White House. And now they have a much broader platform than the Nazis and the Klan had then. I mean, we had to struggle to get our hands on Nazi propaganda. We subscribed to all the Nazi newspapers and Klan newspapers, and we had like some clandestine post office box in Oakland because we didn't want them to see us getting their stuff. Obviously, we weren't going to give them our home address. But now anybody can go online and find anything in 5 seconds. And you don't even have to find the really weird, wacky, out there stuff. All you have to do is find Breitbart or Drudge. So, you know, it does create an environment. And one of the things we hope to accomplish in this discussion is to have everybody discuss how do we manage the challenges now.
Yeah, I want to add a few other things I think that are both parallels and also differences, maybe. I think one of the things that did distinguish John Brown Anti-Klan Committee at the time and to this day is that, in my experience, we linked the question of, and I think Lisa said at the beginning, we linked the question of being anti-fascist and anti-Klan to being pro-Black liberation, and worked very much on the leadership of Black liberation forces throughout. So, for example, I was originally part of a group in California, which is called Take a Stand Against the Klan. We were working with New African People's Organization and Malcolm X Grassroots Movement people, and they pushed the two different organizations to combine forces. And so there was kind of a refounding conference of the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee in Chicago, at which people from Chicago, people from New York, people from California came together. And part of the unity was that idea of being a solidarity organization with the Black Liberation Movement, not only an anti-fascist organization. I think that was critical because it did distinguish us from a lot of other organizations at the time. There was a national anti-Klan network in that period. There was the Center for Democratic Renewal. There were, you know, Southern Poverty Law Center. I think maybe already existed. So there were these sort of NGO type anti-Klan organizations, and then the kind of coalition ones. The Greensboro incident in particular related to an organization that was from, I think, the Workers' Viewpoint Organization, or one of the party building Maoist groups that, you know, saw doing the anti-Klan work as building their party. John Brown Anti-Klan Committee distinguished itself from all of that. It was not an NGO, it was not a party building organization. It was an anti-fascist and pro-Black liberation organization. I think that was really critical. I think the other parallel is to today is that it was committed to direct action and, you know, self-defense. People did training of various kinds, certainly, you know, martial arts and other things to say we want to be prepared to hold our ground if we're, you know, confronted. We were doing, you know, cultural work and punk scenes and other stuff at the time. I was in L.A. for most of that. And so in 83, actually, there was a triple cross burning in Los Angeles, which was Metzger and the war people from San Diego, local neo-Nazis and Klansmen. And then people came down actually from Idaho, from the Aryan Nations. They had kind of a unity rally and burned these three crosses, which we saw definitely as what people are talking about, you know, sort of the unification of the Nazis and the Klan and these other white supremacists. And some of those people then went on to become the Order, the White Supremacy Underground. They were involved in, you know, armed car robberies and other things. So they were, you know, just people need to be aware of what the terms were and some of that stuff.
We also worked with some Black community groups at that, and again, somebody's going to have to tell me the year. There was a Nazi formation within the police force in Richmond, California. They called themselves the Cowboys. Did some outreach. I actually don't know where they did outreach to us, but the Black community there was organizing against that sort of gang within the cops. And we did coordinate with them and go to Richmond, and there was a large demonstration of people from the Black community and from our committee and other people who knew about the situation there. And we kept a campaign going on that for quite a while. So these are just examples of sort of how we made the relationships that led us to unified action on things that affected third world people far more than it affected us. So it was a very active and very confrontational form of solidarity and activism.
I'll just say one other thing. Is subsequently, I was involved with the Anti-Racist Action Network. I think something else that distinguished John Brown Anti-Klan Committee was we did talk about actually women's leadership and women's role. Talked about women's leadership, both with women's leadership within the anti-Klan activity, but also the question of women in the Klan. And the role that they were trying to play in organizing white women on a basis of racial solidarity. And I think that also distinguished us somewhat from some later anti-Klan activity that became a little more male-dominated and kind of emphasized street fighting in a way that was mostly about guys doing it. So I think that is something else that distinguished John Brown Anti-Klan Committee in that period and is an important lesson for today. Just to say, pick up what Les said, same thing in L.A. There was a group in the L.A. Sheriff's Department called the Vikings, which was an organized white supremacist gang, essentially, inside the Sheriff's Department. They also had another one called the Wayside Whiteys, which was at the Wayside Honor Farm, one of the, you know, L.A. County has the largest jail in the world, basically. The guy who was one of the leaders of the Vikings became the undersheriff and in charge of all, eventually, this is like into the 21st century, he was just indicted by the federal government for his involvement in organized brutality inside the L.A. jails. All the L.A. sheriffs basically get their first assignment is inside the jail system, where they learn how to brutalize and, you know, see themselves as the enemies of Black and brown people in Los Angeles, even if they're Black and brown themselves. So that institutionalization of white supremacy, I think, was also something that John Brown dealt with, you know, that some groups still only focus on the sort of from below neo-Nazi stuff and don't recognize the state connection.
I should maybe just add that we did, unfortunately, it's all the materials are archived at this point, but we put out a regular newspaper called...
First it was called Death to the Klan.
Yeah.
then in an effort to have a more mass appeal, we changed it to No KKK, No Fascist USA. USA.
Which we took from a band called MDC, a punk band at the time. They use that as a chant in a song.
So it warms our hearts when people chant that now.
So we put out yes, it does. No Trump, no U.S., no fascist U.S. Anyway, we did newspapers. We did a, what do we call it? The anti-Klan kit or something like that?
Oh, yeah. This was during Nancy Reagan's Just Say No to Drugs campaign. So we did a Just Say No to Nazis campaign.
Yeah, it was a kit. Yeah, we put together bumper stickers,
stencils, so you could do your own spray. We could send people a stencil, and they could do their own spray painting in the mail.
Yeah,
it was actually very successful.
Because
I think one of the other things that we did that I think was a strength, even though at the time we didn't really see it that way, was we worked with anti-racist skinheads, and. Because we were willing to be open to any people who wanted to do anti-racist work. And so just because people that we came in contact with weren't in the more traditional forms and places where the left looked for people, like labor unions, we met a lot of people who gave us a lot of great ideas. And we worked with anti-racist skinheads all over the country who took the Just Say No to Nazis kit and put it to use in their own areas. And that was great.
Yeah. And we did have three very large punk rock, Rock Against the Klan shows, one with the Dead Kennedys and MDC and some other bands that were hot at the time. This was in the early 80s. So we had fun, too.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, you had fun.
And the Nazis always called us the James Brown Anti-Klan Committee, which they thought was a big insult, and we thought it was way cool.
There is a video that was made to almost at the tail end called Behind the Burning Cross, Racism USA. So I just found the copy and digitized it and put it on YouTube.
Behind
the Burning Cross, I think it's Behind the Burning Cross, Racism USA. And I'm sorry, I don't have the link with me, but I think if you Google John Brown Anti-Klan Committee video or that title, or email me and I'll send you a link. It's antiracistaction_LA@yahoo is how to reach me personally.
I found it in a second on YouTube.
Okay, so. All right.
And actually, all of our publications have been digitized and are on file at Freedom Archives. So if you look in there, just search for John Brown Anti-Klan Committee. You can read all the back issues of Death to the Klan and No KKK, No Fascist.
Just one other thing. In 1981, January 1981, the Ku Klux Klan, which had endorsed Ronald Reagan, who announced his campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where the civil rights workers were killed by the Klan. So they announced a rally in D.C. for his inauguration to welcome him. There was a national mobilization that people went to, primarily the black residents of D.C., but also with support from some of the demonstrators chased the Klan out of D.C. In 81.
And we chased them out of Meriden, Connecticut. We learned I was still living on the East Coast at the time, that the Klan did a lot of organizing in all throughout the Northeast and in Connecticut. In particular, there are major weapons companies like Smith & Wesson.
Submarine manufacturers.
And that's where they were doing a lot of their organizing amongst workers there. And they announced that they were going to have a rally in Meriden, Connecticut. And we announced that we were going to have a counter protest. and the cops announced that they were going to pat search all the protesters who went to the counter, who were going to protest the Klan, so to make sure that we didn't bring weapons. So my lovely colleague, who I was hoping would be here today, but isn't, Terry Bisson, we came up with an idea that we would give the protesters lunch. So every protester who walked in got a can of frozen Coke and a pita sandwich filled with gravel. wrapped in plastic wrap and handed out in front of the cops as everybody walked in. Here's your lunch. And we were able to chase the Klan away from the City Hall steps that day. However, we learned an important lesson as well. After the hail of pita sandwiches, I wish we had a film of that, that would be so cool. The police took the Klan away because they were scared to leave by themselves. And then we made a big mistake. We didn't leave. We just had a big victory, and then the Klan was gone, and it was nobody there but us and the police. And then they decided to attack us. So a lesson that I learned from that, which I applied very recently at the Milo Yiannopoulos demonstration, was after you have your victory is a good time to leave. So I share that.
All right, once again, you've made it to the very, very end. Thank you for listening. If you can, hey, send the show to a friend, share it on social media, tell somebody to check it out. Maybe they've got 30 minutes or an hour, unfortunately, that they have to take before they get to work or they're walking to school or something. But hey, this is a great way for somebody to plug in where they don't have to read a long article or see something online. It's something that they can interact with in a different media form. So please, if you can, hey, share this with a friend, somebody that's on the fence that wants to come into these ideas and get involved. And thank you to the Roar organizers for allowing us to record. Thank you for the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee for not only showing up and giving their thoughts and feelings about past decades of struggle, but also for allowing us to share this with other people that maybe have no idea what the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee is. And if you're listening, if you want to support our work, you want to continue allowing It's Going Down to grow and expand, please go to itsgoingdown.org. Drop some money in our tip jar. Make sure we're around next time. We're still coming at you. We've got a lot more podcasts planned. We look forward to the task ahead and the work that is yet to be done. Thanks a lot for listening.
Death Brigade 2015. The bloody Vikings of the beat, it's us. No one is illegal. One place of rock, rock papers for an accent. Your presence here is an acceptable accident. You turn back to the public, your level's excellent. Your speed and lies in the eyes and never hesitate. You know what I'm saying, if it's time to spray your prayers, then look the other way for terrorists, mothers and slavers. But if you're running for your life and to escape the slaughter, then let your wife die to feast on your sons and daughter. Poison the water, the feast of legalized murder. The lies about human rights don't cross the quarter. The bond evolved, let them be strong, walls the border. And feed the world another day for double-dumb reporter. Forward to the past, can I ask you remember? And the allies are sending people back to gas chamber. To feed the beast, at least you know what to expect. The circle borders and the history repeats itself. Papers, please, think that you're on your knees. Straight face, face to the death, death to the police. Who's the real illegal people, who's the real disease? We all immigrants, we all refugees. Papers, please, think that you're on your knees. Straight face, face to the death, death to the police. Who's the real illegal people, who's the real disease? We all immigrants, we all refugees. The circle closes and the history repeats itself. Like 80 years ago, abandoned and close to the death. Who happened to be born on the wrong side of the fence? Ignoring all the atrocities and cries for help. They're all those empathy, balance, lost humanity. Progressive water, the society begets another malady. The remedy, humanitarian calamity. And other people deny the right to live in vanity. Another human race catastrophe. Another instance of entitled message showing lack of empathy. Authorities are waging war, you people lie in idleness. Refuse to take responsibility for leaders' violence. Communities of human priests reveal their rotten values. Civilized war devoted basic principles of kindness. Close-minded, close the borders into denies. The price of economic confidence, they're in a Somali. Papers, please, they got you on your knees. Straight face, face to the death, death to the police. Who's the real illegal people, who's the real disease? We all immigrants, we all refugees. Papers, please, they got you on your knees. Straight face, face to the death, death to the police. Who's the real illegal people, who's the real disease? We all immigrants, we all refugees. Face the facts, no thanks, you pass but black steps. Please go back for war, torture and the death camps. Join the ranks, labeled as illegal people. Cost by those who suck blood from all the golf sneeple. From the family's tragedies to the devilies. They put another spike fall on the land they seize. But why research price lost evidence? Infection of the whole soul and all genesis. Papers, please, they got you on your knees. Straight face, face to the death, death to the police. Who's the real illegal people, who's the real disease? We all immigrants, we all refugees. Papers, please, they got you on your knees. Straight face, face to the death, death to the police. Who's the real illegal people, who's the real disease? We all immigrants, we all refugees.